Hello and welcome to the Love of Cinema, a Picture House podcast. My name is Sam Clements and welcome to the September edition of our show. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been a great summer of movies and we are now slowly transitioning into the autumn where a lot of big hitters are coming out, starting with this month. Really pleased to be able to show some of the films that we'll be talking about on today's episode. I guess if you follow film news, the big film that everybody has been waiting for quite some time now due to reasons beyond our control, is James Bond's latest outing, No Time to Die. At the time of recording with our guests who do mention this film, we didn't know when tickets would go on sale. The film opens on the 30th of September. We knew that, but we didn't know when tickets would be made available. We have now been told by Universal that tickets will go on sale on Monday, the 13th of September, at Picture House Cinema. So do check the Picture House website, follow the Picture House social media channels, and all of the showtimes and various screenings that we'll be doing will be available there. That's just a little bit of admin, a bit of housekeeping. Another very important bit of admin is to introduce our special guest hosts on today's podcast. I am thrilled this month to welcome two podcasters, writers, just people I greatly admire and am such a huge fan of. It was such a good bit of news, actually, to get them on the Love of Cinema this month. So this month's episode is guest hosted by Empire podcast host, Empire writer, generally lovely human being, Chris Hewitt. And Chris will be co-hosting with the now, sadly, former editor of Empire magazine, Terry White. Terry's last issue of Empire was actually the September issue, I believe, which is on shelves now if you're reading this. It's a really lovely issue, lots of great stuff on there, an amazing feature about Edgar Wright's new film, Last Night in Soho. Do check that out. But Terry has sadly now left Empire after 6 years, and she is on to pastures new. But over the years, I've loved reading Terry's work in the magazine and hearing Terry on the rival podcast to Empire, in a way, the sister podcast Pilot, an amazing television podcast. So two podcasters of great renown guest hosting this month, and they will be talking about some incredible films coming to your local Picture House this September, including Annette, including herself, and the latest installment in the ongoing Marvel franchise, Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. Right, well, that's quite enough from me. We will now start this month's podcast with Chris and Terry talking about Leos Carax's latest film, Annette, written by Sparks, the band Sparks, who you may have seen earlier this year in Edgar Wright's documentary, The Sparks Brothers. This is the film that they were working on in that movie. It's out. It stars Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard. Anyway, Chris and Terry will do a much better job of talking about it than me. This film is at your local Picture House from the 3rd of September. It's well worth checking out on the big screen.
First time I fell in love. Woke up next to the girl and escaped fast and far.
So Terry, what did you make of Annette? What did you make of that utter weirdness?
I mean, utter weirdness is a very apt and correct description. Do you know what? When I started this film, we can say, because it's the initial setup, it starts with the director in a booth at the mixing desk, basically about to direct the action. And they start a song, which is literally called, I think, So May We Start, and off they go dancing. And I was like, oh, fuck, this is not going to be for me at all. This is just going to be too weird. I'm from a council estate. I just can't handle this level of art house movie. And by the end, I swear to God, I was probably the most moved I've been by any film this year. Were you not moved to your very soul, Chris Hewitt?
I was moved in various ways. I have to say I'm completely the opposite to you in the opening sequence. I think the opening sequence is one of the most exhilarating things I've seen in cinema in this year. I was going to say in a long time, but I can't remember anything that's happened beyond 2021. So I'm just going to say this year. I thought it was terrific. The way that, not to spoil things too much, but it does start with Leos Carax himself and his daughter's there as well. So
his real life daughter.
Yeah. So already you have that theme about father-daughter and connections right from the off. Then you have Sparks themselves, because obviously it's written by Sparks and all the songs are by Sparks and they're in it. And then you have the actors as themselves getting ready to start the film and they're singing this really catchy Sparks song. And I thought, yes, absolutely, because I knew it was going to be strange and weird and, you know, but exhilaratingly so. For me, at times, it was a bit of an endurance test. Luckily, I've seen it twice, and I think the second time is the charm, because you begin to lock into the rhythms of it, you begin to obviously know where it's going on a character level as well, and you begin to allow yourself to sink into the weird idiosyncrasies, and it's a movie that is almost entirely made of weird idiosyncrasies. So it just takes a little while to lock into it. And Karrock's decision to have Annette, for example, personified by a puppet, which is his idea. It's not something that Sparks did. It's not something they suggested. Wasn't in their script that they gave to him. They developed the movie in a very, very interesting way. So all those things, the fact that Adam Driver's character is an extraordinary bellend and blowhard and just quite difficult to spend time with. But the second time around, and it's going to be difficult because not everyone's going to have a chance to see a second time around. So I'm fascinated. You know, have you seen it only once yourself?
I've seen it only once.
Okay, so and you loved it. You really locked into it straight away.
I did, but it took a while throughout the film. I went on a very kind of big arc between the beginning of the film and the end. And it is funny because Henry is somebody I had issues with. He does play, Adam Driver plays this, you know, incredibly angry, embittered, cynical stand-up with a incredible six-pack, which he shows off as he stalks the stage in a dressing gown. And, I mean, he does that very well. Let me just be the person to say I saw flashes of Kylo Ren. Like, the impact of toxic masculinity on the modern man, like, yeah. Those are two character studies right there. But anyway, but he's a very difficult, abrasive character, and what you think begins as a love story between him and Anne, the gorgeous, brilliant, wonderful Marion Cotillard, who I will say I felt like should have had a bit more to do, but nobody lights up the screen like her. She is a movie star in the old Hollywood fashion of movie stars. And what begins as a love story, I mean, descends quite quickly into obsession and anger and bitterness. I mean, it's quite a true to life depiction of some modern relationships. There's lots it says about celebrity, there's lots it says about love, there's lots that said about how some people's lives are owned. But as you say, it's idiosyncratic, even down to how it uses the musical, because I suppose more traditional use of musical is for high emotion, is to say things often that cannot be said only through song. That it's really the desperate lows and the epic highs that are expressed through the musical form. Here they do that, and then it will be literally the most prosaic, mundane dialogue. So not quite, I'm going to the shop for a cheese sandwich, but a little bit like that. And that kind of, those things for me should grate against each other, but kind of don't almost. But I agree with you on that it is an endurance test at times. There are bits where you feel like it's kind of, I don't know if I'd use the word bloated, but it's definitely not as tight and pacey as other parts. But by the end, I'd forgotten all of that. I'd just so desperately fallen in love with this absolutely mad film, which is essentially art house, but as a rock opera.
Yeah. And that's not, I came round by the end. I think it's absolutely fantastic by the end. And for all the bits that you have to endure, all the bits that you have to pick your way through, there are moments that are just lift you out of your chair. And I saw it in the most unedifying way as well. You know, not the way that Les Carrick or Sparks would want me to see it. I saw it on my computer screen because I couldn't get to a screening. And it's, you know, I do want to see it with people and with an audience and, you know, see and have that immersive experience. But there are moments in it that are just almost transcendent. The beginning, I've watched, you know, because I have a link, lucky me, I've watched the film twice, but I've seen that opening sequence a number of times. I've gone back and just watched that opening sequence. I just think it's tremendous. And there are other moments where, as well, Simon Helberg, who is Howard from The Big Bang Theory, is an extraordinary talent as well, which, you know, I'm a big fan of The Big Bang Theory, so it's been evident to me for years, but there's something about him as well. He's got real musical talent. He plays an accompanist in this movie, and he plays a piano for real. There's a sequence where he's conducting an orchestra and sing-talking as well, and bringing the audience up to date and where he is and what he's feeling at the moment. The camera's whirling around him. It's just absolutely gorgeous stuff, and he's really, really solid as well. Ultimately, by the end of it, I think the biggest compliment that I can pay the movie is that it feels like it was directed by Sparks. You know, there's such a synergy between Leos Carax and Sparks as creatives that it just feels like it's all coming from one source. And I knew nothing of Sparks until I saw Edgar Wright's documentary. You know, they were a rumor to me. I thought they were something completely different than what they actually are. But I've since immersed myself in the world of Sparks. And so I know you can tap into their little pool of weirdness, and this is all springing from the one pool. And so if you love Sparks at all, I would say that you will love Annette.
I thought that was a fascinating discussion, and I am so intrigued that Chris has not only seen the film twice, but has seen the introduction to the film a number of occasions. I mean, he is right. The film starts with quite the scene, but the whole film is a thrill ride, and it sounds so good on the cinema screen. Music is a huge part of this movie. So yeah, good film to see on the big screen, a good film, a great film to listen to in a cinema auditorium. For sure. Well, up next is Herself, which is at your local picture house from the 10th of September. This film is remarkable. Played at the Sundance Film Festival a couple of years ago. If you attended the Sundance London Film Festival, this was actually our surprise film screening at that event back in August. So I know maybe some listeners here would have seen it already. But it was a joy to listen to Chris and Terry talk about this movie. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to play Chris and Terry's review, and then we're going to go straight into an interview with the star of the film and the co-writer of the film, Claire Dunn. And Claire is interviewed by Felicity Beckett, who is, if you watch the Picture House Cinema's YouTube channel, the host of all things Picture House video. So we're going to have Chris and Terry talking about the movie, going to have a little jingle, and then we're going to go into Felicity Beckett talking to the co-writer and star of Herself, Claire Dunn. Without further ado, over to Chris and Terry.
What can I do for you? I want to build a house. These are some of the vacant sites that you have. You see, if you lend me the money and let me use a site, then I could have that built for me and my kids. I'm really sorry. I can't help you with this.
So, Terry, and I think if my Irish accent becomes more exaggerated during the course of this review, then I apologise. But what did you think of Herself?
Oh, my God. I think that was a crime against the Irish people, but we'll let that one slide. So this is the latest from Phyllida Lloyd, obviously the director of Mamma Mia, The Iron Lady, numerous Shakespeare and stage plays. She did the very famous all-female Shakespeare. Hands up, I have to say at this point, I am a huge Phyllida Lloyd stan. I think the woman is incredible. This, for me, is a real quiet, understated gem. It stars and is co-written by Claire Dunn, who has had a relationship with Phyllida through theatre for years. And what they've created for me is something really, really rare in this area. And we should just say this is a film about domestic abuse. It's a film about a woman who leaves her abuser with her children and about how she tries to rebuild her life quite literally because of a crisis in the Irish housing system. She essentially can't get a house for her and her kids, so she's on a really long waiting list. And so with the help of a woman she works for, played incredibly as she is in everything by Harriet Walter, she essentially builds her own house and the community comes together to help her. It sounds, do you know what? Let's just say out loud, this could sound like a Hallmark movie. Kind of empowering woman, finally breaks free from brutish man. This film has so much more nuance and delicacy about it. And what for me it does is it treads a really interesting line. I've spoken a lot about my personal experience with domestic violence, how that affects when I see this in film and TV. And what you often see in film and TV these days is a really kind of realistic but often brutal depiction of what it is to suffer domestic violence as a woman. This film, for me, and I know Claire Dunn has spoken about wanting to make a story that wasn't something she'd seen before, in terms of it not having, I suppose, a more statistically typical ending. And so what you get in this film, she treads this amazing line between the reality of the situation, which is, you know, how hard it is to leave, how hard it is to exist with your children within the current system, how hard it is in the courts. And then she balances it with this, and I wish there was a better word than empowering, but I can't think of one, because there's, you know, in that courtroom, she begins a monologue, which begins after she's asked why she didn't leave, et cetera, as women often are. She says, ask better questions. And it's the start of an exceptional monologue. And you've got the power of community who come together to help her build this house, the ultimate good of people. And I think people may be tempted to call this sentimental, but it's really not, because it's relatively restrained and sober. It doesn't flinch away from showing some of the violence. It opens with quite a difficult scene. But what it doesn't do is kind of leave her there and really give the sense that there's no future or there's no way out of this. And so you see a more optimistic side to this scenario without, and this is really important, undercutting the seriousness of what's being depicted here, because statistically, the time a woman will most likely be murdered in a relationship is when she's leaving. That is statistically proven. And you feel that, and you feel that threat. We should say Ian Lloyd Anderson, who plays her husband, has incredible menace in this, but they don't allow that to overpower what is essentially her story and that of her children. I just think Phyllida Lloyd has such a quiet power, and I think people often don't fully appreciate her. I read a review somewhere which said, oh, there's some montages in there of house building to pop songs, but let's not forget this is the woman who did Mamma Mia. It's like, let's not also forget that this is the woman who has directed some of the most incredible theatre performances to ever come out of this country. Like, she is a brilliant filmmaker, and her restraint and the dignity she lends this film, like, I will fight anybody about Phyllida Lloyd. Am I going to have to fight you, Chris?
Mamma Mia 2 is better than the first one.
I mean, that's probably a fair point.
But, I'm only kidding. I'm only stirring things up.
What did you think?
No, I honestly, I was, I thought it was terrific. I thought it was terrific. And like you, I know people who have been through experiences like this. And so it hit fairly close to home as well. I was surprised whenever you said that you were moved by Annette. I assume this movie moved you as well, though.
Mm, yeah.
To this, because I thought this was absolutely terrific. And Claire Dunn, to my shame, I hadn't really been aware of, because I'm not a huge theatre head, but she's terrific. And the fact that she co-wrote this as well and shepherded it through, what was it, 5 or 6 years as she was writing the script, and she's great. You know, she anchors the movie, she feels utterly real and utterly lived in as a character as well. Kids are great, Harriet Walter's great, everyone's great. And it is hard to watch at times, but stick around, because don't worry, there's a pop song along there's a pop song along in the next scene. But no, it felt uplifting, and it feels like a movie that does, I think, say that there are escape routes out there for women who are subject to violence at the hands of these men. And I think it could be a very important film, as well as a very, very watchable one.
First of all, before we discuss the film, I wanted to discuss the incredible backstory and the amazing cast of characters that are involved in bringing this wonderful film to fruition. So can you tell me a bit about how you came to write the screenplay and all the people that came in to support you?
Yeah, sure. It's brilliant to be on the podcast, so thanks for having me. Basically, it started out with me just having an idea when I was living in New York doing some pilot season auditions. And my friend, who's a single mother with 3 kids, rang me and said, oh my God, I have to declare myself homeless on this form because I can't find anywhere to live. She got very short notice to move house, basically. And there was just nowhere to move to. There was a housing crisis raging in Dublin, still is. And there was just nowhere to go. And my friend is so determined, so independent and so hardworking. And I just think it was very hard for her to have to do that. It was quite a moment of like, wow, something's really wrong here. And so I suppose I was sitting there, I was really just like angry on her behalf at the injustice of all this. And then I was sitting in New York going through all these auditions and reading some good scripts, some not so great scripts, and sort of like just like wondering what I'm doing as an actor, you know. And I was in this moment of fantasizing on her behalf, basically. So I started fantasizing about her self-building house, and I was like, she'd be the best at that, you know, because she can do anything like that. And then I basically Googled about self-building cheaply in Ireland and discovered that this guy, Dominic Stevens, had built his own house for €25,000. And I was absolutely gobsmacked. And, it just set something alight in my brain. And I was trying to learn my lines, couldn't learn my lines for the next day. And I was like, oh, my God, this is such an amazing concept that you can build a house for so cheap. And then basically just as my head was falling to the pillow that night, it was like, boom, this story came to me. And it was this woman, she builds a house for herself, a community forms around her, a new set of kind of friends and the right kind of help. It's like she starts it, she instigates it. So it calls in a different kind of help to begin the rest of her life. And I knew she had to be getting out of a really tough situation. And because of that point, I'd already been working for Phillida a couple of years at that point. And we've been doing all these workshops with amazing women and doing workshops in prisons and in Brooklyn with really poor children and stuff like that. And basically my eyes were really widened open to the problem of domestic violence being this like really, really big cause of so much actually crime. It has this knock-on effect, not just for the perpetrators, but for the partners. If they want to survive, do they end up, they end up committing crimes, etc. And then also the children of parents that have experienced that, it really affects them as well. So basically, that was the situation I saw her trying to run from, because I thought you'd have to be able to dare to dream. And it was kind of like it just came in that flash that night. And the next day, it was like after the audition, bought a notebook and decided to begin.
And I just was marvelling at how the manifestation of our dreams, that your in your dream and your idea of the story is the same as the manifestation of reality for the people that appeared to help to make this happen.
It's as simple as Sandra was building a house and Claire was building a film. And I had to be exactly like Sandra sometimes. I had to just like, at first it was that thing of like reaching out and asking for help. And the first reach out was probably Sharon Horgan, because actually I had her email address just because she couldn't attend something that I was performing in, but I couldn't believe she wrote to me personally to say she could make it. And I was like, wow. And then it was only a month or two later, I had the courage to go, God, I'm just going to send her a draft and ask her company to look at it, thinking I'd never hear back or hear back in 6 months' time with a nice Dear John letter or whatever. She wrote back, I think, within 24 hours saying, can we talk on the phone? I really like this. And it was like, what? Do you know? And I still remember talking to her on the phone for like an hour. I'd never met her. We were on the phone. She was in New York doing the divorce series. And she was just like, look, my company have not made a film before. We're only fledgling. We're only starting out. But to me, this is a story that I would love to help be told. And, I'd love to help you make it happen. And I remember I hung up and I went to the shop and I bought some Prosecco. That's what I did. And so I kind of knew if I have Sharon Horgan back in me, things could happen. So I finished my process with, because I had it in with Screen Ireland. I had gotten a little fund as a writer solely on my own. And then once I finished that process, Sharon came on board and she was like, okay, we got to attach a director. We probably have to get an Irish production team on board. And at the time, then later in that year, it would have been late 2016, I was doing the trilogy with Phillida by that stage. And at this point, Phillida had read a draft of the film and was just kind of like a mentor and said like, oh, you know, give me a few tips and ideas. And she was like, I think it's a really good story and blah, blah, blah. And actually kindly, she asked me over for lunch and said, you know, I won't be able to direct it now. And I was like, oh, I'm not asking you to direct it. Don't worry. Like it was really, I really didn't think it was going to be in her realm of ability to do it because of her schedule, let alone anything. And then a couple of days later, she just texted me and said, I'm directing your film. And I was like, what? And she said she just kind of had this, you know, when you have one of those moments where you're really asking yourself what matters as a storyteller to you. And actually, it just really aligned with all the work that we were doing in the Shakespeare stuff and the not so, just socially conscious work or anything where you're just having a good old yarn about the things that are wrong with the system, but envisioning what we can be. And like, you know, she's into like casting people and heard voices and unheard, you know, unseen faces. That's what she's interested in. So am I. And also because all of we discovered about these amazing women that are so seen as a kind of drain on society or not strong or as victims. And it was like we had this chance to maybe make something that had a different tone and a different aspect about the so-called archetypal battered woman. And it was like, come on, like she realized that it was a real opportunity. And also because she'd never done anything low budget, she'd get a lot more, I suppose, artistic authority over it. So she realized, hang on a second, you know, this is actually gonna work for me.
So let's talk about Sandra. And I think one of the things that I got from Phillida, because I was very lucky to interview Phillida at Sundance, was the portrayal of Sandra being a survivor and not a victim. So can you talk to me about just how important that language and that framing is in the wider battle against domestic violence and state neglect?
I mean, it's just so important to me because I met women who had already been through this and they were on the other side of it. So I was meeting these extremely, frankly, honest, but amazingly happy, cheerful, life-affirming people. Like they were incredible and they'd already been through this and they were able to talk about their trauma without it re-traumatizing. Like basically I met people who were far on the other side and then I met people that were working on the front line with it. And I was like, how can we get from A to B, not just quicker, but with more people? Like, you know, and really it was so important for me to show that when these women told me their stories, I felt like I was listening to soldiers talking about being on a war front. I even read a book where it aligns three case studies of a woman coming from domestic violence, a guy who survived the Holocaust, a Jew who was in a camp, and a soldier back from the Vietnam War. So this huge study that was done, I think it was back in the 70s or 80s on these people, aligning like all of them are in this, they have the same conditions, they have the same problems after what they've been through, and they need the same healing process. And I wanted to show, I was like, wait a second, this is the level we are talking about that these women are at. And I really wanted to show the process of the mental growth from it as well. And just like the fact that gaslighting literally affects your neural pathways and you have to regrow, like you really have to relearn everything for yourself and learn how to make decisions for yourself, but also learn how to trust again and sense who you can trust. So I really wanted to show that and show the grief of it as well, because these people are in love, like they've been in love with this person for years, even though this person did this to them, they have to grieve as well. So there's so much to show as well in terms of when they have kids that the abuse might continue on access visits. It's like, we have to look at this, like really look at it.
Yes, it's so complex. And I really was in awe of how sensitive the portrayal was around the violence and the complexity of the emotional, not necessarily the growth of Sandra, because she was already that person, her drawing on her own resources.
And beginning to learn how to trust them and trust herself. Like that's what the whole thing is. And also we really didn't want to glamorize the violence. So actually when you watch that film, it's her experience of the violence. It's not actually us showing each hit, but you see what the result of it is. You feel it with her. And that's what the sound and the music and the edit is doing. It's really trying to make the audience feel like this woman might have felt, rather than go, oh, here's another picture of a man beating a woman, you know? And that was really important to us.
And then the actual sort of final message of the film, which obviously the domestic violence is thematic and important, and obviously it's a statement, but ultimately, and I think it was Phillida Law, and it is in the film where the Conrad Hill character, about Mehol, and I think that is such a prescient, important message for now. What are your feelings about the film now? You finished it 2 years ago, I think, didn't you?
Yeah, like I'm even more behind that message now after what we've all been through with the pandemic. Like, I mean, I think we all feel connected on technology, but Jesus, like, if anything, the coronavirus reducing you to a physical space of like much, much more local made you think about what it means to be a good neighbour. Do you really know what's going on? People, are you connected to people around you? I still battle with that in Dublin. I think, you know, it's just hard. People are very afraid to open up to each other. And actually, like, I think communities can be so much more important to your quality of life than you realise. Like, you can have an amazing big gaff. Like, I'm looking at a woman out there that's like, she's got this millionaire size house and everything. But like, I don't know who she is. Like, across the road, I'm like, I don't know who that woman is, but I know everybody in the flat building here. Or like, you know, it's that thing of like wanting to feel more connected to people, but also remember who we were before the technology, before the Industrial Revolution, because that's what I ended up discovering Mehel from. Mehel came from what Irish people used to do before we were colonized and then became, you know, much more developed and then became our own country and then just took on the model of capitalism because we didn't really know what else to do. And so it was really about remembering who we were. And we used to just be these small groups of people. And we used to, when a family was starting, just build a house for that family, give them a few chickens and a few seeds to start growing their veggies and their potatoes and everything, and give them the beginning of their life. And that was just a given in our country. Like, that was just like, it was the circle of life. It was literally that, like, and I just think it's nice to remember that, like, just remember these things. I wonder, can we fuse these things into this highly technological, fast world we have? Can we remember that? Like, so I'd love that message to really sing. And also just the message of, like, to all those Sandras out there, like, you can make the first step. I'm not saying you can build a house. I'm not saying you have to go through what Sandra went through. But if there's anything in you that thinks, like, I think I need to make a move here, well, then you can do it. Just be safe, be sure, and make that first step as safely as you can, and there will be somebody there to listen.
Well, thank you so much to Claire Dunn for joining us. Claire has been so busy since making herself. Once you see the film, you can see why. Claire is very in demand. It's great to be able to talk to Claire for the podcast. Again, something totally different. I think this is a very interesting sandwich of movies here. It would be a strange, beautiful, but very delicious and fulfilling sandwich, this triple bill of movies that we're talking about this week. We are going to end on the latest installment in the Marvel franchise. Marvel have had a film out already this year, Black Widow, which I greatly enjoyed, but I must admit I enjoyed this one even more. This is Marvel's Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. It's a brand new character for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I always love when they throw something new in the mix, and this film is quite unlike anything they've done before. I think getting Terry and Chris on this episode to talk about this movie was great casting. Empire are very well known for their excellent coverage and love of these films, and they can really look at it with an expert eye. Well, Chris can anyway, as Terry will explain in the introduction to this review.
The Ten Rings gave our family power. If you want them to be yours one day, you have to show me you are strong enough to carry them.
So, to my shame, I haven't actually seen this film because of, shall we say, a lack of screenings. My northernness, as in I live in the north, not that I come from the north. They're not like banning northern people from seeing Shang-Chi. But I've been very excited about this for a long time. And you kind of know my Marvel tastes by now, Chris Hewitt. I like the new and I like the different, and I like it when they go bold and big. Am I going to like Shang-Chi?
Yeah, you're going to love this movie.
Yes.
I think. And I love this movie as well. I've seen it a couple of times now. And it's knocking on the door, if not quite inside my MCU top 10. And I know that sounds like a crazy statement, but when you consider that this is the 25th film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I think it's entirely legitimate to say that this movie is knocking on the door of the top 10. Maybe not quite in there, but it still means it's a very, very good film in its own right. And it feels to me like one of the boldest steps that the MCU has taken in a while. There are still echoes in there. I won't get into spoilers, but there are still echoes in there of Marvel formula a little bit. There's still an element of CG overload in the final act, but where it goes in the final act and the sights it's showing you in the final act, I don't think I've seen in the MCU before. And I think it's startling and really refreshing in its freshness. And so this is obviously about Shang-Chi, who's played by Simu Liu, and he is a real discovery. They've done it again. The Marvel's incredible casting people, Sarah Halley Finn and her team of casting people, go out there and they find these incredible stars. The first half in particular just feels like kind of unlike anything you've seen in the MCU. We're with Shang-Chi. It presents his story as a mystery. We're getting little pieces of information parceled out about him as we're going, and about his background, and about the fact that his father is Wen Wu, aka who we know as the Mandarin, who is a centuries old Chinese gang boss and a warlord. And Shang-Chi is essentially running from his past because his father wants to take him back into the fold for reasons that I shall not disclose here. And as you're going with him and Katie, who is his best friend, played brilliantly by Awkwafina, who is one of the funniest characters in the MCU, just absolutely brings such wonderful levity to the movie. You're just thrust on this journey as they go from place to place, as they go from fight to fight. And whenever this movie was first announced, you know, when Destin Daniel Cretton came aboard and, you know, he assembled an incredible team of stunt choreographers, including the late great Brad Allen. This is one of the last movies that Brad Allen worked on. You were hoping that the fight scenes would pass muster, and they are tremendous. The fight scenes in this movie, I think, are probably the best fight scenes in the MCU. They're amongst the best action scenes that Hollywood has produced in the last couple of years, I would say, as well. Maybe even going slightly further back. The opening sequence, there's a bus fight, which you see, if you've seen the trailer, you'll know there's a bus fight. You haven't seen the half of that fight. There is some extraordinary choreography, augmented slightly by CG, of course. There's a wonderful fight on scaffolding, but each fight feels slightly different. Each fight uses his location in a slightly different way. And Shang-Chi himself is a compelling figure to get behind. He is charismatic. He is slightly tortured, but not so much so that it's a turnoff. And the movie gets more emotional and delves deeper into his background. There's really lovely use of flashbacks, very elegant use of flashbacks that just build upon the story and fill in the blanks about what we don't know of Shang-Chi and his sister Xia Ling, who's played brilliantly by a newcomer called Monger Sang, who is this was literally her first film. First time she was ever in a movie set was when she set foot on Shang-Chi, and she's got such extraordinary poise. She's gonna be a big star, I would say, as well. And then of course you have the great Tony Leung as Wen Wu. And, you know, one of the world's greatest actors. And he really brings it. There's a real depth to the father and son story here that goes in ways I think were fairly unexpected for me. So, I absolutely loved it. The third act, first time around, especially the third act, lost me a little bit. The story of this week's podcast is clearly that I need to see films twice. Maybe I'm not paying attention first time around. Who knows? But the third act does lose itself a little bit in CG overload. But as I say, the images that it brings you are startling. And the emotion that it's going for is real.
I must admit, listening to Chris talk about that film has made me want to go back and watch it again, which I probably will, because I am a bit of a fanboy when it comes to these things. It's so good to see on a big screen. And I must admit, I went to a screening of this film and I saw it on one of the biggest screens I think I've ever seen. It looked and sounded incredible. And if you are a Marvel Comics fan, there's two more Marvel films coming out this year. We've got Chloe Zhao, who won the so many Oscars earlier this year, including Best Director Oscar for Nomadland. Chloe Zhao is now turning her hand to a Marvel film with The Eternals, which comes out in November. And then in December, we've got the third installment in the Tom Holland Spider-Man franchise, Spider-Man No Way Home, which, I mean, you've probably seen the news. It broke the record for the most trailer views on YouTube ever when it was released in late August. Now, it would be rude to have Terry and Chris on the show and not ask them what they've seen in cinemas recently that they'd like to recommend, and also what they're looking forward to coming out in cinemas later this year.
I'm going to be entirely predictable and true to form, and I am going to tell people who haven't seen it, or maybe have seen it once, to go and see Censor, Prano Bailey Bond's incredible debut film. which I reviewed for Empire, gave it 4 stars, but she's been getting 5-star reviews across the board, including from Mark Kermode. I love this film and became a bit obsessed with Prano actually, and went and kind of found her shorts and her music videos. And Neve Algar's in this, who is, has done some brilliant stuff so far. She has got such an insane amount of talent, and this entire film hangs on her and her performance. She plays a film censor in the 80s who discovers a horror movie that seems to reference or recreate something that happened in her childhood with her sister, and it's her pursuit to understand that and to get to the bottom of it, the unravelling of her mind. Is her mind actually unravelling? Visually, it's absolutely stunning. As I say, the performances are incredible. The production design, the creation of these offices and where she lives, like the detail in these scenes is perfect. Anybody who had a landline in their house will get flashbacks to sitting waiting for Bobby Coleman to ring. Not that he ever did. So I absolutely love this. And I think this is one that's going to stand, in terms of British horror, is going to stand the test of time and is going to end the year as one of the films of the year for sure.
I'm going to go for Sola. I think there's a load of great films in cinema right now. There's Candyman's fantastic. I'm going to have my cake and eat here by mentioning a whole bunch of other films. The Courier with Benedict Cumberbatch is really good. It's a really good cold war thriller and character study. I think Candyman is fantastic also. And I had a good time with Reminiscence, which feels like one of those movies that they say they don't make too much anymore and no one's going to see it, and then that might be a reason why they don't make movies like that anymore. But it's movie stars being very, very handsome and a fairly interesting story and great visuals as well. But Sola for me I thought was absolutely terrific, and it feels a little bit like the Something Wild for this generation, Jonathan Demme's Something Wild, in that it is about a descent into madness that contains within it a really, truly terrifying, quote-unquote, bad guy performance from Coleman Domingo, who is wonderful in this. He plays a pimp who is essentially his one of his ladies is Riley Keogh, and she recruits Taylor Page, who is a waitress, to go to Florida for what she is told is a night of dancing, but it's actually much darker than that. And this was based on a Twitter thread that popped up a few years ago and has now been turned into a movie by the director Janiska Bravo. And again, a bit like with Censor, the visuals here are astonishing. Bravo's command of the camera and her sense of what she wants stylistically and visually, well, I just have to say bravo. It's great stuff. The performances are wonderful, but I genuinely feel that it's not the sort of movie that tends to gate crash the Oscar race. It's a bit too hip, it's a bit too knowing, it's a bit too modern. I think it might turn off an awful lot of Oscar voters. But Coleman Domingo's performance as this pimp who can switch from cool, suave charm to terrifying psychosis in the blink of an eye. And he also does this really interesting thing where he has an American accent when he's being nice, and then when he is being nasty, he adopts a Nigerian accent. And it's a wonderful bit of acting, the way he's able to switch back and forth. It's very, very interesting. He's brilliant, and he's had a great year. And I would say that he might be a contender for Best Supporting Actor, a nomination at least. Go see Sola.
So, films I'm looking forward to over the next few months. I couldn't choose one, but I have chosen two. And those two films are Titane. Is it Titane? I always say Titane. Tito? You know, the winner of the Palme d'Or. The absolutely, what looks, I haven't seen it, what looks to be deranged, amazing film from Julia Decarno, who did Raw, which was one of my favourite films of 2016, I think it was. We went big on it in Empire. I just thought that was one of the most interesting, exciting horrors we'd seen in years. It's been a while since that, but she has come back with a bang. The artwork looks incredible. The responses out of Cannes were incredible. I think she's an absolute searing filmmaker, and I cannot wait to see that. And my second choice is another woman I feel pretty much the same about, who is Celine Sciamma. director of Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which was my favourite film of last year. It was the first film I took my son to see at baby cinema when he was 6 days old. It will always be special to me because of that, but it was just a phenomenal piece of filmmaking, tender and intimate and sumptuous. And she's following it up with something that looks quite different, which will be her fifth film, Petite Maman. And it's, we think it's about two childhood friends. We don't know very much about it. We have a first look at it in Empire, actually. But she is such a singular filmmaker with perspective and with a real sense of who she is and what she wants to say through her work. I think it's whatever this film ends up being, I am here for it and I cannot wait to see it. She is incredible. Those are my two films.
I'm going to go, because I am such a cliche and I am Mr. Blockbuster Boy, I'm going to go for No Time to Die. I'm going to go for the movies I think can get people back in the cinema in fast, fast numbers as well, which is something we all want to see. So No Time to Die, which I think really has the potential to be Daniel Craig's best Bond. It's his last Bond, so he's got, this is it. This is the one that will decide whether Daniel Craig has a 3 or a 2 average in a way. So either his films will be 60% bad or 60% great. So you'll have Casino Royale and Skyfall on one side, and then you have Quantum of Solace and Spectre on the other side. And this could tip the scales either way. So hopefully, fingers crossed, this is great. And then he has a better average than most Bonds, I would say. There you go. So No Time to Die looks fantastic. I'm also going to say, because I'm obviously such a big Marvel fanboy, Eternals, because I don't know what that movie is.
I don't think anybody knows what that movie is.
I hope they do. I hope that they know what that movie is, because Shang-Chi takes some really bold swings, and I hope that that will continue with Eternals. I'm fascinated to see how they're going to marry Chloe Zhao's sensibilities, indie sensibilities, artistic sensibilities, with the big Marvel, big budget CG machine. And then, of course, I have to mention Spider-Man No Way Home, because I think that has potential to be the biggest film of the year, in a year, obviously, when that probably means less than it did in previous years. But I think that could be the one to really, really make a big cultural impact. And I'm fascinated to see how they're going to fold in Spider-Man's past into this movie. I have no idea what it's going to be, but I'm excited about it. Where can you find me? Well, luckily I have a GPS tracker implanted in my just under my skin. So if you want to track me, you can just literally find me. Just type in Chris Hewitt into Google Maps, and there I will be. So come and seek me out. Don't do that, please. I'm really, really just very antisocial and awkward in the flesh. It will be a huge disappointment for all concerned. But you can follow me on social media. I'm at Chris Hewitt on Twitter. I'm at CTAH1976 on Instagram for some reason. I don't know why I'm not Chris Hewitt on there, but there you go. And of course, you can find me on the Empire Podcast and our Empire Podcast spoiler specials. Now, that part is subscription only, but I tell you, folks, it's worth it. It's really good. It's really, really good. And I'm not just saying that because I'm involved with it, but also the regular Empire Podcast, which is free, is out every Friday and is a ton of fun.
It is. I mean, I will say, because I did used to edit Empire until 3 days ago, and it actually absolutely is worth it. I can vouch for it completely, honestly, and independently. I am no longer at Empire, so you can't find me there. You can turn up if you like, but it will just be Chris.
That was absolutely said in the tone of my captors are treating me well. That felt like you were holding up a newspaper with today's date on it.
Oh no, that's Lassie. So you cannot find me at Empire, but you can find me at Terry _ White on Twitter, Terry L. White at Instagram, where I will, well, now I no longer have a job. You can find me, you know, chilling, watching movies, watching TV. My book, Coming Undone, is being adapted for television, which hopefully I'll have more news about very soon. But until then, bye Empire. I'm still an Empire stan forever. Empire forever.
Right, well, that's quite a month. And we didn't even talk about James Bond No Time to Die, because it hasn't been shown to critics yet. Nobody has seen it yet. But it is, I assure you, coming to cinemas on the 30th of September. And as mentioned at the top, tickets go on sale on the 13th. So check your local picture house. If you're looking for a particular screening on opening night, I would recommend getting in there early, because if past James Bond films are anything to go by, it's going to be quite busy. And there we go. Thank you so much for listening. It's great to be doing these podcasts. It's so nice every month to have a new guest critic in the reviewer's chair. I thought Chris and Terry were superb. Do give them a follow on social media. And as Chris mentioned, the Empire podcast is a thing that he does every single week. I'm hooked on that show, and I love their spoiler specials where they go into really great detail about all the bits that people don't normally talk about in interviews, the endings, the twists, the turns, etc. They will be doing one for Marvel Shang-Chi, I am sure, and I am also sure they'll be doing one for No Time to Die at the end of the month. So give them a follow. Give that podcast a listen, and hopefully we'll see you at the movies. There's so much on right now, all of the new releases. We're also showing some classic movies. We're just coming to the end of our Wong Kar-wai season at Picture House. That then goes into the we're partnering with the BFI to do a season of classic Japanese films, including Tokyo Story, Seven Samurai, again films that are really designed to be seen at the cinema. Before you know it, we're going to be programming Halloween movies and Christmas movies and all the seasonal stuff. So check your local picture house for details. You can see all the listings at picturehouses.com. You can also follow Picture Houses on social media at Picture Houses on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. Lots of great stuff there, including some competitions, if that's your thing. And we couldn't do these podcasts without the support of Stripped Media. Thank you so much to Kobe and the team at Stripped Media. Thank you so much to Maddie Searle for editing the show today. And a big thank you again to Chris and Terry for hosting, to Claire Dunn for being our special guest, and to Felicity Beckett for doing that interview for us. We'll be back in October with our October episode, where we'll be covering big films like June, Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho, and yes, there is a new Wes Anderson film, The French Dispatch. Keep subscribed to this channel, because throughout the month we might have a couple of bonus extra podcasts, might be a couple of interviews that we do. We are hoping to be able to speak to somebody from No Time to Die, that's for sure. If that happens, that will be on this feed towards the end of September. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the movies. We'll see you next month.